Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
The decision-making process is something which is very imperfectly understood. How it works, what triggers it, what influences it is known to a certain extent, but not fully. And there is a lot brewing under the surface that both arbitrators and counsel struggle with. And certainly in arbitration, arbitrators, there is such an intuitive persona, such a personal relationship to the decision maker in a way that there is, and I don't think, certainly not in national courts, that aspect of it becomes very, very important.
This episode of International Dispute Negotiation addresses the critical issue of bias in international arbitration. It's a discussion with London-based arbitrator Sophie Knappert, who recently completed the editing and assembly of a very large compendium that will be issued in the July 2008 issue of Transnational Dispute Management, an online magazine dedicated to international dispute resolution. In this interview, Sophie discusses the many ways that bias is appearing and being dealt with in arbitration around the world today. What constitutes bias? How is it measured? How is it determined? How is it regulated? How is it different and how is it common from one place to another?
My name is Sophie Knappert. I am a Canadian by birth and I come from Montreal. But I have spent the past too many years practicing in London in arbitration.
We don't, as a matter of policy, ask people their age on these podcasts because there's the concern is that the answer might come, the question might come back the other way as well.
I'm 44 years old, which as I'm increasingly told, is a crazily young age to do what I'm doing. But as I think you and I have discussed in the past, I'm now doing the job of an arbitrator full-time in a barrister's chambers with the hope of providing a bit of a different model as an arbitrator, something that is not taken on at the end of a career, but very much at a very active time in a career.
You've now compiled a total, I think, of some 24 articles.
Correct. It is a Transnational Dispute Management is an online journal of topics, very much seeks to be very much on top of current trends in international dispute resolution. And arbitrator bias, bias is a little bit of a... as I say in my written editorial, it can be offhand a little bit of a four-letter word. I mean, it comes with a very negative perception. It's a bit of a catch buzzword for as a title, a bit of a snappy title. But really what is meant is not only the negative part of bias, i.e. negative prejudice, but mostly what informs an arbitrator or a decision maker in terms of their own background and how that can influence their decisions. That is what we sought to explore in this issue.
There was what you're saying then, if I understand right, is bias as it relates not only to the perception of bias that parties may see when they appoint arbitrators, but biases that may exist naturally and that may genuinely influence an arbitrator to decide to make a decision one way or another.
Precisely. And that bias, those received ideas that each of us have, be it from culture or education or simply the place where you were born, the language that you speak, your cultural references, all of these things which are ingrained, most of which, I think, when you do this professionally, you are aware of, but some of which perhaps you're not. So that's what it means to refer to.
Let's talk for a second about perceptions of bias before we get into whether bias is actually a heuristic or something that influences the actual decision-making process. I think before we get there, you know, I as a representative of a party or being a party in an arbitration proceeding, I'm often very, very concerned about, you know, the relationship or the perceptions of biases that an arbitrator may have towards the other party or biases that they may have against us as a party for one reason or another. Tell us a little bit about the articles in this issue of TDM that address perceptions of bias in the appointment process.
There are several of those that seek to address perceptions of bias. Some of them hail from how these perceptions are seen in investment arbitration versus commercial arbitration, for example. Is it more important in a public interest arbitration? Is more importance placed on perceptions of bias in the public interest arbitration than in private interest arbitration, or is it really equally important everywhere? These are issues that are being explored. We also have contributions from several parts of the world where people have sought, contributors have sought to isolate how they perceive bias in those parts of the world. So we have contributions from the US and Canada, Europe, of course, civil law, common law jurisdictions, but also Russia and Asia. And certainly the contributions from Asia show quite a different aspect from what the Western world may be used to. So there is definitely
in what way? I mean, can you give an example of how bias may be perceived differently in Asia than it would in the West?
I think the cultural expectation, from what I understand in the articles, the cultural expectation of behavior from an arbitrator or the way an arbitrator would treat the process or go about the business of deciding is different. And there is a lot more, the lines, for example, between adjudication and assisted settlement or mediation are a lot more blurred than they are certainly in Europe.
So there may be a higher or different levels of tolerance for bias, say, in an Asian culture than there would be, you might have in some Western cultures. In other words, there will both be points at which parties will not want to tolerate bias, but perhaps the tolerances themselves may vary from one place to the next.
I think vary is exactly the right word. I think I don't know that we can speak of higher or lower, frankly. I don't know that they can be compared because it is very much a matter of what the parties expect and find acceptable. It would also appear, as I was reading the contributions that came along, that there is quite, well, Professor Flader would say, an unrealistic expectation in the West that arbitrators ought to be totally free of bias, totally bias-free, that parties expect their arbitrators to have basically very little, almost lead an otherworldly existence for some reason. Yet at the same time, they are very pleased to have arbitrators that have, you know, practical experience that can hail from, you know, having been in the real business world or legal world or otherwise. So there's very much a bit of a schizophrenia there that appears to exist.
So, by the way, you mentioned earlier a data point which I found interesting, and I'll mention it again, that you're 44 years old, I'm 45, and I've had discussions recently with people who are about in our same age group, and you have to wonder if there's also a something of a generational difference in perceptions of bias. There was an approach that I've seen, or there is an approach I've seen among some, I'd say, more senior arbitrators, that they are so esteemed and so well-respected that they are above the possibility of bias, or they're above reproach as to the possibility of bias. I'll tell you a quick story here about an arbitration, but it was reflective of, I think, other arbitrations in which I've been involved in. And this was some years ago. I won't identify the country or the people involved, but it was a case where we sat down at the first hearing after the tribunal had been constituted, and that we noticed walking into the building, we had noticed on the way to the hearing, having faxed the letter to the tribunal, that the counsel for the other side, and actually it was a counsel who had joined the other side's team after the tribunal had been constituted, had the same fax number as the chair to the proceedings. And they didn't identify any relationship on their letterhead, and nothing had been said to us. And when we mentioned this at the proceeding, the chair basically said, "Oh yes, well, when you came into my office, didn't you see that we both have our names on the doorbell?" To which we said, "Well, no, it wasn't so much that we didn't notice. In fact, we didn't notice that, but that's not the point. The point is that this seems to be a relationship that wasn't disclosed to us." I have to tell you, I don't think that that's an approach that's been, again, maybe there's a generational difference. And I don't know if it's appropriate to speak in those terms, but I certainly haven't seen that shared by people of let's say, our generation, which I guess we fall into what, the Y generation? Is that who we are? Or the X generation?
You certainly fall between two chairs, is what I found in terms of generation. But yeah, let's say Y.
I mean, without being appearing to be critical of those who are still, not just have come before us, but who are still before us and who are very esteemed and very good at what they do, do you think that there are, in some cases, let's say there can be also, as much as there are cultural tendencies, but also generational approaches or differences with respect to bias and the treatment of bias?
Without wanting to pass a judgment on it, I think it's something that that is seen. What you describe is certainly not unheard of at all. But in terms of a generational gap, it may well have to do think offhand it has to do with two things. The first thing is the fact that we, yours and my generation, have grown with an access to information that is so much greater than the people who came before us. And so there is information, and the access of information is something that we consider valuable. The previous generation perhaps had a different outlook. The access to facts was less prized than someone's reputation or gravitas or authority. And so what you said or did not say in the generation above us was less important than who you were and the decisions you took and the trust you inspired. So that would be the first reason. And the second reason is, I think, of course, only very recently has international arbitration started to not in investment arbitration, which has completely broken down the barriers of confidentiality, but certainly in commercial arbitration, commercial disputes, only very recently has confidentiality or privacy started to loosen up a little bit. And I think the previous generation of arbitrators held the sort of secretive nature of arbitration very as a fundamental tenet of that the linen being washed in private was a very important thing, and now it's almost, in certain areas of arbitration, it's very much frowned upon. I think their outlook on the role of an arbitrator is extremely different from the way that you and I see it. And again, one thing that is another very striking feature of international dispute resolution and the way it's going is the fact that the onward march of transparency and disclosure is a tide that cannot be stemmed. I mean, once you go down that route, there's no going back. And I think that is a challenge, perhaps, that generation of arbitrators has to deal with.
Well, let's use that then to talk about the existing guidelines. I know that there are several articles in this compendium that you've put together that address how the world today tries to regulate the issue of bias and the disclosure of facts that may give rise to perceptions of bias.
As always, when there is a phenomenon such as the one we're dealing with here, there is an attempt by professional organizations or associations or gathering of lawyers to try to put some order where there is chaos. And certainly the idea is to educate lawyers, but also to guide arbitrators, because not all of us are seasoned, and not all of us have very many war stories. Some of us are starting out, beginning with me. In the decision-making process, and guidelines are there to try to help you through the path. Now, the International Bar Association, the IBA, a few years back have published their famous guidelines on conflict of interests with their three color-coded lists, the red, orange, and green lists. These guidelines are now very well known, as you know, in our field, very criticized, as always, with these types of exercises, but still quite frequently, I think, referred to for guidance, which is precisely what they aim to be. They certainly were not meant to be the last word on the subject. Now, the IBA has, I think the guidelines were being informally referred to by arbitrators and parties, but for some reason have not made it through the courts. I mean, certainly in the UK, and I think in the US there's been a couple of instances, but in the UK, to my knowledge, there's been very, very few, only passing references to those guidelines in cases where arbitrators have been challenged. And I think the IBA would like to see that its guidelines are a little bit more publicized, and if they are not being mentioned, why that is and what can be done about it. So there is a committee, a subcommittee of the IBA that is chaired by Matthias Scherer of Lviv in Geneva, who is tasked with, and in the interest of disclosure, I should say I'm a member of that committee, tasked with the work of identifying within several countries, whether the courts refer to those guidelines and in what context, and there will be a report. Matthias has produced an article for this special issue explaining a little bit what that entails. In America, as I'm sure you know, the ABA has, the American Bar Association, has come out with a draft report on disclosure obligations or recommendations as to how much disclosure arbitrators ought to carry out. There is an extremely a very wide-ranging type of situations where one would have to make disclosures. Social engagements or gatherings, the fact that you and I are talking now, which are being, of course, being looked at quite closely and commented on, and that's the subject of a contribution by Mark Cantor to the special issue. Now, what I'd like to know, and I know I'm not supposed to ask questions in this exercise, but I'd like to know, you as a user, I mean, do you find that too far going, or is that something that you think is a good development?
It's interesting. That's actually something that we had a previous podcast with Mark Cantor, and we talked about this. And I've always felt that disclosure is very important. I mean, for me, bias, there are just two types. There's the one that's disclosed, and there's the one that's not disclosed. I'm very much less concerned about possible sources of bias as long as they're disclosed to me. So yes, I'd say disclosure is very important. And the more that is disclosed, I'm inclined to accept a fairly high level of perceived bias, again, in our own appointments here, because I think if the person is, I almost think you appoint an arbitrator who will have to deal with perceptions of bias. You do so at your own risk.
I think you put your finger on a very important point, and that is something that I think comes out of the special issue as a whole is, as you say, it is not so much what is there in terms of bias or received ideas within an individual. It's the fact that you say nothing about it that irks and that jars with the users of arbitration. And the disclosure, it's what you hide that people do not like, the fact that you're hiding it. And disclosure, I think, goes a long way towards making people accept, as you say, a few things that perhaps they would be less willing to forgive you if you don't say anything about it. So that does seem to militate in favor of heightened disclosure. To whether one ought to disclose, you know, membership in a golf club or sitting on a seminar panel together 5 years ago, I'm not sure. But certainly, the idea of saying or putting something face up on the table is a very attractive one, I think, for parties.
Right. I guess my only question to that, or my response to that, is what is the downside of disclosing everything that you possibly can? And I mean, if you leave something inadvertently out, but you've disclosed a wide range of potential facts, aren't you, as an arbitrator, putting yourself in a better situation, and the parties also are going to be happier that you've done that? I guess I've always grappled with what's the downside.
I think apart from the fact that you feel completely exposed, well, but I suppose it comes with the territory. You know, your life to an extent is no longer your own. Certainly, your professional life is no longer your own, and your professional associations matter. And so I can see the sense of that, and if it is something that makes the parties happier. But there's also, of course, for the arbitrator, I would say perhaps the downside is that if all this information becomes public, then at one point it will come back to haunt them for some reason, and some things that they may not consider of any particular consequence, a friendship or a professional acquaintance, may come back and deprive them of appointments that they would be ideally suited for. I don't know. That would be perhaps the downside for me. For example, there is the argument that developing notion of issue bias or issue conflict in primarily in investment arbitration, where arbitrators are being challenged because they have taken a position in writing, in an academic circle, or in a seminar, or certainly in their professional activity, for or against a certain point, and then they're being called upon to decide in a manner inconsistent with that previous position. And the argument is being made, well, the downside of that may be that you are hampering by muzzling the people who are the more knowledgeable on certain topic, you are hampering the development of the law. I don't know. That is another argument that is being developed in the special issue. I mean, I think the middle ground there is shifting still. It's unsettled.
It's a very interesting and as we both know, a very controversial area. Whether issue bias can even be said to exist as a legitimate bias is, I don't think the jury's back in on that one yet.
I agree. But we have some of the articles are dealing with that, and so I think, and they're very up to date. So it would, you know, it's an area to follow. And incidentally, actually, I wanted to say that TDM have see this special issue very much as a stepping stone towards a continued discussion on this topic. I mean, this is not going to be at all the last word on it. And I certainly am very much hoping that it will foster, you know, it will get people thinking about the topic and hopefully foster further comments or contributions or articles and so on on this topic.
I mean, it's certainly one that's not easy to address if you say that issue bias does exist. I mean, we've mentioned, you know, the question of disclosures about existing relationships one may have. But if you want to talk about what arbitrators or potential arbitrators can do when it comes to issue bias to avoid being challenged on that grounds, you're almost inviting them not to comment and not to develop an academic record and not to speak in public.
Precisely. And that is what I find regrettable, because these are people who have a lot of interesting things to say, and they are asked to sanitize everything and to refrain from coming down in favor or against certain points where not only arbitration practitioners, but the younger generation of arbitrators would benefit from their views. So certainly there are instances where you know, certain positions taken very publicly on fundamental points are incompatible with then having to sit in judgment against that position. But these would be, in my view, would appear to be quite the extreme cases. But of course, that also opens up another interesting area, related area, which should there be a different standard of independence and impartiality, in this case, probably more likely, in the public interest cases, the investment treaty cases, than there should be in commercial arbitration. By accepting to sit in judgment in cases where the political stakes are very high and states are parties and there is a very high expectation of accountability, are those arbitrators basically shutting themselves out from being able to express views in public the way that judges of the ICJ would be, for example? That is another question that is certainly far from being settled and is being talked about in the special issue.
Got a couple of topics here that I think cut across culture, legal systems, and generations, and get almost at the nature of the human brain.
Yes, absolutely.
An article by Dieter Flader and Joe, actually two articles, one by Dieter Flader, one by Joe Matthews, that address this topic, that bias, a certain level of bias, may simply be inevitable in everyone.
Yes, it is. It became apparent very quickly with that sort of topic, we were dealing not only with the legal strata, but also with something a lot deeper certainly as a lawyer, you are, a lot of us were uneasy in putting our finger on. And so the idea of bringing in Professor Flader was to try and get the perspective of a trained psychologist to understand how the decision-making process works and whether bias is an inevitable part of it. And from his perspective, his interest in it was how well do the legal tests that are being devised to try and circumscribe bias and stamp it out and sanction it, how well do they really correspond with the way the human brain works when making decisions? And he has rather surprising conclusions, very interesting conclusions. And Joe Matthews, who is a U.S. Litigator and counsel in arbitration, takes the same approach, but not from the view of psychologists, of course, but from the view of counsel pleading in front of a tribunal and trying to get into the minds or get under the skin of these individuals on the tribunal and how best to play their inherent, their received ideas, their prejudices, their inclinations, and how a U.S. advocate would play that to best effect.
The strategic use of bias.
Precisely. Precisely.
Well, On that note, I think this is a very interesting. It's obvious, I think, to me and as anyone who's listening, that why this is such a hot topic currently in international arbitration. And I thank you for taking the time.
It's a great pleasure, and I hope you enjoy it. I really do. I certainly did.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.